short on paper.
Is it?
Yes, see? There's always. It was off, the whole thing.
Again.
No, that's what I told John. He forgot to open it to record stuff last session. I never let just go to your office record it. But no, I'm busy. There's no good answer for that. Just try to bang it more to for the dent to show up.
And another question is that in this similar project, when I said that, you know, we were trying to download images from different websites, how do you cite those images? Like,
that's a good point.
Like, thousands of websites.
So you have to provide the links to them.
To all of them?
Yep. And also you need to be sure that it's in the public domain, so no copyright laws.
Okay.
I have a famous image of a cow that I would talk to you about later on in another course. It was a really expensive cow. A few hundred thousand euros of for the cow, just because they used the image not cited.
So if it's a YouTube video and I'm just, you know, taking a screenshot of the video, it's public, right?
No.
It's not.
Not everything that you have access to means it's public. Somebody owns the right to everything.
Yes.
Unless they basically put it in the Creative Commons part. They agree to share it.
But even in that video, that guy, that person, what he did was he sort of, he just gathered images from the internet and then made a video. So when I'm using his work, I'm not using his work, I'm actually using someone else's work that he has used.
It's not the best example, but what you're saying is that somebody else stole something, I went and stole it from them. That's more or less, it doesn't work like that. Then the original one. First of all, I would not use somebody's stolen stuff. But if I use it, then I would cite the original one. You should really be careful about citing all these copyright laws, all the citations. So you have a copyright issue, you have a plagiarism issue. So it's not simple. You need to spend time on that. You need to get permissions. and it's not.
Even though it is a kind of very common to common thing to do.
Yeah.
But it is not legal, and if somebody wants to start a case, then.
No, there are ambulance chase lawyers who do. So when it comes for the cow, there was this cow. I'll show the image to you later. So there was, I had a colleague in my PhD universe group who was working on image segmentation. And his segmentation was working so good that it was able to segment a cow, which the cow was, you've seen these black and white cows?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to segment those. At least it was hard to segment those 10 years ago without deep learning. So his method was working on those cows as well. So what he did in his paper, he reported, I think he published in one of these good conferences, was he searched the internet for a cow, downloaded the image, applied his segmentation technique, got it out. And then, we're really obsessed with that. Then, so after a few years, we got a letter from a lawyer suing the university for a few €100,000. The lawyer didn't own the picture of the cow. The lawyer just went and found the photographer of the cow. And it was a big, big deal in the group, in the university, and like even the head of the university was involved to take care of it. So you can't just download stuff from somewhere, even if somebody else has already done it.
So it depends also a little bit on the community in which you are doing the research. So coming back to color and imaging, so there are kind of quite well-known image databases to use.
Nowadays there's
then
a lot
it's
of public data.
Kind of straightforward to cite them. And
there's a lot of nowadays, especially when it comes to images, there's lots of people uploading their stuff, and a lot of them agree with these Creative Commons that you could use it.
Mm.
But you can't just use it because you find it on the internet and everybody has access.
Another thing to add is that Google also allows you to print it out images based on their licenses.
Yeah.
You can select images like when set a printer, so Google will only show you images that are and permissive license or open source license.
So considering a good journal, if it has high impact factor, should we consider this a good journal?
Yeah, high impact factor.
Yeah, unless proven otherwise.
At the same time, it is perhaps also the bottleneck is a kind of smaller than other journals to get in. So then you need to have a really, really good work to demonstrate.
So impact factor is not necessarily the only thing,
no.
But it could be one of the important.
Mm.
There's no good number, at least I can't come up with a number because it depends on the field, depends on the journal, depends on what kind of. You could have a journal of research, journal on research, which publishes everything. You could have a journal on really specific niche sort of thing. So there's no good number for that.
There is also another metric called edge index, right?
Yeah.
So it's like the difference between the impact factor and the edge index.
Hmm.
Same person and
exact same set of authors.
Yes. Then you then a good approach would be to contact the editor of the journal and tell them that's the case. Because yeah, that's not how it should be. And then when it comes to your question about how what was it, the quality of the reviewers?
How reliable.
So previously the number of journals was really limited, and then reviewing for journals was an honor. These days I receive like 2 or 3 reviews requests per day, and I do not select any of them because I'm too busy. So if I don't accept it because I'm too busy and I'm a junior member, then you could imagine how lower it would go.
So it's a kind of it's a huge jungle out there, you know. Different journals or different editors, they have different procedures. For some editors or for some publication, you can, as an author, you could propose a kind of experts. In others, you can't. Then you have editors. They kind of blind select 3 reviewers, so the 3 reviewers, they do not know each other. Then you have others, they know each other. And so therefore it can happen, you know, that you have a reviewer or even 2, you know, who are very amazed and pleased about your work. And then you have one who is basically just kind of negative to your content. So it's impossible to generalize. So it's it is.
It's a, as you said, jungle, and it's also a business.
Yeah.
And I remember the publisher MDPM.
Hmm. Then you have of course. So you do a particular work, you have read certain papers, then you understand that, okay, the work I am doing fits perfectly in this particular journal, because most of the other authors, they have published in the same domain. But then you are short on time, because you need to submit your final thesis, PhD thesis, and you need to have the paper reviewed before the defense. Then suddenly the strategy might change. So instead of using the proper journal, you might need to choose another journal. So there are multiple factors which might play into the reality. So that just happens to one of my PhD students, even though the plan was completely different initially, but then towards the end of his period, then we had to change the strategy. Other questions?
What's a scientific poster?
Like the ones that you have like in the walls, because actually for
those are not necessarily scientific posters. They're conference submissions which are accepted as a poster, and that depends on different conferences. As I mentioned, the acceptance rate for posters like GPCR. Now I forgot. Whatever ECCV is less than 10%. So then it's basically as good as any paper, if not better.
Mm.
But then there's some journals, there's some places that they basically accept anything.
Mm.
And then there's a difference also in some conferences, there are difference between, so again, in the case of ECCV, for example, there's a 4% oral presentation acceptance rate, 10% poster. In the case of EI, electronic imaging, and CIC, they don't care. So the quality of the journal, the publications are not different. It's just that the editor board or the basically conference chair thinks that this paper would be better if it's in a poster scenario, so there's more interaction there than a normal presentation. So again, it depends on what you're dealing with, or what conference you're focusing on.
So the content that you have submitted to the conference remains the same. It's just the presentation mode, which is either an oral presentation, or then you have a poster presentation. Sometimes you're able to take what you prefer, sometimes not.
The person in the poster gets less, the information is the same, but you have to summarize more because you don't have two pages.
Yeah, but then you get to interact for like 1 hour, 2 hour with the people who come.
Yeah.
So that's another advantage.
Exactly. So if you have a poster and you have a good space where you can present next to the coffee machine, for instance, then you suddenly have a lot of audience, you know, to interact.
Yeah, I know.
Compared to if you have an oral presentation, you know, which lasts 20 minutes. And then another comes.
When I was doing my PhD, I remember my other PhD students, they used to buy biscuits and cookies and put next to their posters. That would make people come and they could interact.
Yeah.
Because that's the goal. The goal is for you to interact and talk with people. And if you stand next to a poster without doing anything, then that's a waste of your time. That's why I would encourage you to go to the poster session in CBCS and talk with the other students.
I have a question that can be quite odd. Is the data that you're using to publish a conference paper also valid to use in a journal paper afterwards?
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
because
so
you're
no problem.
No, because that's a public data set that everybody could use. If you have a data set, you should make it public. If it's not public, it's a useless data set. You just have a bunch of personal images that you're not sharing with anybody.
When you submit like your paper to some journal, don't they make it private because you have to pay for the paper? So you're not like losing your rights to use.
Yeah, you are. Basically, when you publish a paper in any venue, you sign an agreement which they basically own every single thing.
Mm.
They own everything, but if there's any problems, like the sample of the cow, it's your responsibility.
But if I am like publishing the data set that I create,
no, they don't own the data set. They own the text and the images in the text and the figure. But the data set, the programs, they don't own that.
So typically, a generic research process might be like that so you have a kind of an idea, or you have agreed a topic or a method with your supervisor, then you do a kind of a pilot project with a pilot experiment. You have a small data set, and then you publish that in a conference. So very often a conference proceeding is much shorter than a journal. And the idea is actually to present that and hopefully to get a lot of feedback and question and interaction. Then you go back to your lab, and then you digest the comments, and then you expand, or you adjust, or you redo, or you do a bigger experiment. And then the question might be, okay, do you use now this existing conference proceeding and you add more stuff, you expand the experiment, the data, the discussion part and the conclusion, or you rewrite from the start and you create a new publication? If it is the second, then at the end of your defense, you can have both the conference proceeding and the final journal. If you then just add a kind of a certain or another chapter to the existing proceeding, then the question is, okay, is the proceeding still relevant, or should I choose just the final journal in the thesis? So conferences are very often to test a new idea or a new method, and then you go on with the journal. Is that typically? Any other questions? What's the time?
It is 10 minutes to 12.
Okay, then you have 10 minutes.
For what?
Call, call the difference.
Okay, then I'll be.
I was not finished yesterday.
Do we have time to get ready?
No.
There is massive business. Both of you have received the program. You have a class with Phil, that I know, you have a class with Stephen, but there is joint class. Bye.
So I just take the opportunity to go through one or two, three slides, which I was not able yesterday. Okay. Okay, so unfortunately it was a bit a rush yesterday, and I just think it's appropriate to mention the most used color differences, because I assume you also will use that in a cross-media color reproduction later on. So the idea of color difference is actually to determine a difference between an original stimuli and a reproduced stimuli. That is the idea. Also, in terms of color or image reproduction, the idea is to reproduce an existing stimuli or an image. And the idea is, if we talk about reproduction, the meaning is then there should be ideally no difference between the original and the reproduction. That is the ideal situation. So in here, for instance, I have this original color checker, and I have to reproduce the color checker. So then, in that case, I have 24 patches. And then the idea is I want to compare the original brown patch. So assuming this is a very uniform area, and I'm going to compare it with the brown patch in the reproduction. And then I compare the skin tone with the skin tone, and the sky blue with the sky blue, and so on. So I calculate in that instance 24 color differences. So I have 24 color pairs. And then I can calculate the average, which then indicates me, providing one number about the difference between these two images, between the original and the reproduction. So that is the idea. So yeah, as I showed, we can calculate the color difference for each of them. Then we talked about color difference delta E AB. So delta, delta E, as it says. So delta indicates always a difference between two items. And E, that is a word from German, Erscheinung, or in English, appearance. So, also delta E, delta color difference. And in an Euclidean distance, as I said yesterday, that is the distance between two points in a three-dimensional color space. So in that case, these are two stimuli, and that is the distance in that case in the C-Lab color space. And then about the methodology, we also talk about just noticeable difference. J and E typically equal to 1. That means that color difference below 1 is not detectable, and the delta E of 1 is just detectable. So then for instance, looking at this schematic illustration where I have these gray patches, so if I have a color difference between these two patches of 1, the same there, the same there, then I can calculate also the difference between this patch and this patch. So these are these two patches, which then is equal to 2. And if I take this patch and this patch as a color difference, then I have a delta E of 4 schematically. And that is the very simple formula to calculate the delta E star AB. So if you use this simple Euclidean distance, then that is the exactly notation. So delta E star and subscript AB, indicating that you are using the simple Euclidean distance. And then it is basically the difference between the lightness in the original and the lightness in the reproduction, and the difference between the A star value and the B star value from the original and in the reproduction. And then you end up with one number indicating the difference. There might be some interest to learn about, okay, I have this difference, but how much is the lightness difference contributing, and how much is the chroma distributing, and how much is the U-shift contributing, then just having one difference. And then you can calculate, for instance, with this formula, where you still have the delta lightness, then the delta in the U-shift and in the chroma shift. So that can be of interest also to indicate. So in a color reproduction, also is it the lightness which is a kind of the error, or is it the chroma, or is it the U-shift? Depending on the application or on the work you do. So that is then cross-section of the AB indicating the chroma shift. So in here, that's the achromatic color, that is a certain hue, and if you talk about a chroma, so that is the chroma axis, then it is the distance between certain chroma numbers, and that is typically then the hue shift, as we have seen, that is the axis blue, yellow, green, and red. So how much is the shift in the red in terms of hue? Then, depending on the applications, there are multiple kind of classifications to find. There is one from Kurt Schlepfer,
30 years ago, and he used this type of classifications. So very small or just a noticeable difference is a delta EAB between 0.2 or 3 up to 1. And then above 1 is considered as a small difference or a medium difference, and above a delta EAB of 6 is considered as a large color difference. Then we talked a lot about the imperfection of SILAP in terms of uniform perceptive differences. So what we have here is there are two prints. So here we have 45% cyan, and here we have 50% cyan, and the remaining percentage are paper white. And the same with magenta, yellow, and black. So I measured this pair with a spectrophotometer, and I calculated the LAB, and then I calculated the color difference between the cyan, between the magenta, between the yellow, and between the black. And these are the corresponding delta E AB color difference numbers. Do you observe something specific
related to? Yellow has like greater delta E, but it's not seems like too different between the first yellow and the second yellow, maybe because our eyes doesn't really sensitive to that color.
That's exactly the point. So even though there is, as I said, not much color management, but it's a fact that the yellow has the least color difference perceptually. And probably now we can discuss, is it the black or is it even the magenta, which has the biggest perceptive color difference. But this is not corresponding with the numbers. And that is the typically disadvantage or the challenge with the current non-uniformity SILAP color space. So therefore, a lot of effort has been done over time to improve the color difference formulas with some weighting functions, with some rotation in the U. And also 30 years ago the AB was constituted in 1976, and then in 1994, kind of very first attempt has been made to do some adjustments to the formula. So where you have some weighting functions in addition to the just simple Euclidean distance. Now, if you look at the numbers, so we can see that it has improved, or the numbers are correlating much better with the perceived color difference. CMC is another type of color difference formula with also different weighting functions. And then the latest one is what is called CIE Delta E 2000. So the point here is to make that the need is to have a formula which gives you values which are corresponding to the perceived color difference. Yes. So that is the delta E 94, where we have some additional weighting functions for the lightness, chroma, and the U. And then we also have some parametric factors to change the relative contribution independently on each color difference to optimize the correlation
to the visual distance. And then finally, at delta E 2000, where you have similar parametric factors as the K for lightness, chroma, and the U. But very important in addition, you have the hue rotation term to deal with the problematic blue region at approximately 270 degrees. So I won't go into further details, but I think I've uploaded, if not this publication, then probably I did upload the publication from Gaurav Sharma on Blackboard. So if you want to know more about the details and the entire formula, which is quite comprehensive, then have a look at this publication. So using Scholar, Google Scholar, and being on school, also through the internet, you have access to that. And I think also mentioned that you have access to all ISO standards. So if you are on campus, or if you are connected via, what is it called? Yes, then you have access to ISO standards as well. Okay, thanks for your time, and we meet again for time two.
Yeah,
it's okay. So, didn't I answer to you? Yeah, I think so.
Maybe I haven't checked it.
Ah, okay. Yes, I did. So I put your name just on Blackboard, you know, where the reference group. And then, beginning of October, I think we take the first meeting. So then, before that, I send you a kind of, what is it called? A questionnaire, you know, with... about the quality of the particular course, and then I would like you to discuss, you know, these questions with the class, so that you have some kind of information from the class, and you have an evening, and then you represent essentially the class, and then I
Das ist ein bisschen Man lever.